Hello, this is Elizabeth Ortel, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the January 5th, 2026 issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. To begin, on the front page, Trump's foray into Venezuela could embolden Russia's and China's own aggression. While both countries were allied with Nicolas Maduro, the U.S. attack could give them justification to use force in other spheres, analysts said. By Anton Trajanovsky, reporting from Washington, January 5th. After attacking Venezuela and seizing its head of state, President Trump said on Saturday that the country had been hosting foreign adversaries and asserted that American dominance in the Western Hemisphere will never be questioned again. His remarks appeared to be a broadside against Russia and China, which both built close ties to Nicolas Maduro, the captured Venezuelan leader. But in fact, there was also plenty in Mr. Trump's words and deeds that Beijing and Moscow could get behind. Mr. Trump's stunning assault on Venezuela has ushered in new uncertainty around the globe, with allies and adversaries alike scrambling to reckon with a superpower ready to use force in the service of a transactional might-makes-right foreign policy. For the two countries long seen as America's chief adversaries, Russia and China, that uncertainty is tinged with opportunity, foreign policy analysts said. If we have the right to be aggressive in our own backyard, said Fiona Hill, a Russia expert at the Brookings Institution, why can't they? Ms. Hill was the senior director for European and Russian affairs at the White House during part of Mr. Trump's first term. In the spring of 2019, she told a congressional hearing later that year, Russia quietly signaled it was ready to cut loose its ally, Mr. Maduro, in exchange for the United States stepping back from Ukraine. You want us out of your backyard, the informal Russian message went, in Ms. Hill's telling. We have our own version of this. You're in our backyard in Ukraine. Ms. Hill said she went to Moscow at the time to reject the idea. Russia never confirmed Ms. Hill's account, but its RIA state news agency reported in April 2019 that her meetings in Moscow revealed serious, deep contradictions and significant differences regarding Venezuela. Now, Russia could well have more luck with such a geopolitical swap, given that Mr. Trump's rhetoric shows that everything can be traded, she said in an interview on Monday. It gives them the opportunity to try it again, she said. So far, China and Russia have condemned the U.S. attack on Venezuela, but they have not threatened to defend their ally. At an emergency meeting of the United States Security Council on Monday, Russia and China demanded the release of Mr. Maduro and his wife and called for a halt to any further military action by the United States. China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi said on Sunday that no country could act as the world's police without mentioning the United States, according to Reuters. Russia's UN ambassador, Vasily Nebenzia, said the American global gendarme is attempting to rear its head once again. But some in Moscow went so far as to offer hints of praise for Mr. Trump's attack. Dmitry A. Medvedev, the former Russian president, told the country's TASS news agency that Mr. Trump and his team have been rigidly defending his country's national interests, both political, with Latin America being the background of the United States, and economic. Give us your oil and other natural resources. The restraint was striking given the investment in Mr. Maduro's rule by both China and Russia. Russia sent nuclear-capable bombers to Venezuela as a show of force in 2018 and ratified a strategic partnership with Venezuela just last October, looking to the country as a platform for projecting its influence across Latin America. China upgraded its ties to an all-weather friendship when Mr. Maduro visited in 2023 and loaned more than $100 billion to the country over the last quarter century, largely in a bid for access to Venezuelan oil. But in the last year, the calculus for both Moscow and Beijing in what they stand to gain and lose in taking on the United States has been changing quickly. Both countries are aware that the consequences of antagonizing Mr. Trump can be severe, while the advantages of flattering him appear significant. Both Russia and China want to prioritize manipulating Trump to achieve more important interests for themselves, said Tang Zhao, a specialist on strategic security issues at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. For President Xi Jinping of China, the priorities appear to include a further relaxation of American export controls and gaining more freedom of action in the South China Sea and beyond. After facing a potentially devastating trade war with the United States early last year, China secured a one-year truce with Mr. Trump in October and gained access to some advanced American computer chips in December. The Chinese leader is now expected to host Mr. Trump in Beijing in April. Mr. Maduro's fall comes with silver linings for Beijing, said Ryan Haas, a Brookings Institution scholar who was the China director on the National Security Council in the Obama administration. Having more American military assets devoted to Latin America rather than Asia is beneficial. So is the increase in Venezuelan oil production that Mr. Trump has promised, given that China is the world's largest importer of fossil fuels. And then there's the legitimizing effect for any future actions that could violate international law, including against Taiwan. America, under Mr. Trump, has allowed itself to be seen as indistinguishable from China and Russia in its willingness to break rules in the service of its own narrow interest, Mr. Haas said. So it removes a degree of pressure on China in that regard. For his part, President Vladimir Putin of Russia has been silent in the face of Mr. Trump's seizure of Mr. Maduro, whom he hosted at the Kremlin just last May. The silence is especially striking because of the Russian leader's anger in the wake of other Western interventions, such as NATO's strikes in Libya in 2011. But for Mr. Putin, the goal in staying in Mr. Trump's good graces is clear: to convince the United States to deliver a Russian victory in Ukraine. The Russians probably think that, as unhappy as they are with what happened, said Hannah Note, an expert on Russian foreign policy, it is an acceptable price to pay if they come out on top in Ukraine. Mr. Putin achieved an end to 3 years of diplomatic isolation by the United States with his summit with Mr. Trump in Alaska in August. His concrete gains from humoring Mr. Trump have so far been more limited than Mr. Xi's, with the White House still appearing unwilling to force Ukraine to capitulate to all of the Kremlin's demands. Ms. Note, an analyst at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies in Monterey, California, pointed out that Mr. Putin has sought to avoid antagonizing Mr. Trump, even though the United States has become more involved in parts of the former Soviet Union, like the South Caucasus and Central Asia. that the Kremlin considers part of its post-Soviet sphere of influence. And Russian reticence to take on Mr. Trump over Venezuela might also stem from the simple fact that there was little Moscow could have done to stop him. Even as Mr. Putin stayed out of the spotlight, Mr. Medvedev, one of Russia's most publicly hawkish officials, gave voice to the Kremlin's pragmatism. Let's put it bluntly, he told the TASS news agency, referring to the United States. Now they have no grounds, even formally, to reproach our country. More on the U.S. operation in Venezuela, Venezuelan oil. Chris Wright, the U.S. Energy Secretary, said the United States intended to maintain significant control over Venezuela's oil industry, including by overseeing the sale of the country's production indefinitely. Cuba's economy, with widespread power outages, medicine shortages, and rising food prices, experts say Cuba's economy has never been worse, with the crisis coming just as the supply of Venezuelan oil is threatened. Intensified repression. Since the U.S. raid, Venezuelan security forces have boarded buses, searched phones, and interrogated people, looking for evidence that they welcomed the capture of Nicolas Maduro, the ousted president. Foreign advisors. The United States is pressuring the interim Venezuelan government to expel official advisors from China, Russia, Cuba, and Iran, U.S. officials said. U.S. Justice Department. The Office of Legal Counsel produced a signed memo declaring it lawful for Mr. Trump to order the military operation into Venezuela over the weekend, according to U.S. officials. The specifics of the memo are unclear. Marco Rubio's role. The Secretary of State helped steer President Trump to attacking Venezuela and seizing Nicolas Maduro, and now aims to force the country to give U.S. companies access to its oil. Why Trump refused to back Venezuela's Machado. Fears of chaos and fraying ties. U.S. intelligence suggested Maria Corina Machado, Venezuela's opposition leader, would struggle to lead the government. But her relationship with Trump officials had been souring for months. Even before the lightning-quick U.S. raid on Venezuela's capital, President Trump had made a crucial decision about what would happen once the country's leader, Nicolas Maduro, was out of the picture. Mr. Trump would not be throwing his support behind Maria Corina Machado, the opposition leader who led a successful election campaign against Mr. Maduro in 2024 and had the greatest popular legitimacy to lead the nation. Behind scenes, Mr. Trump came to his conclusion based on several crucial factors, including U.S. intelligence that suggested the opposition would have trouble leading the government, and a souring relationship between Ms. Machado and top Trump officials, according to five people with knowledge of his decision-making. I think it would be very tough for her to be the leader, Mr. Trump said over the weekend, after the mission ended with Mr. Maduro in U.S. custody. She doesn't have the support within or the respect within the country. She's a very nice woman, but she just doesn't have the respect. Instead, Mr. Trump settled on Mr. Maduro's vice president to take the helm. For Ms. Machado, Mr. Trump's comments landed like a gut punch, and it represented a public break for the United States with a leader who had spent more than a year trying to ingratiate herself to Mr. Trump, so much so that when Ms. Machado was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, which he covets, she dedicated it to him. The president had been persuaded by arguments from senior officials, including Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who said that if the United States tried to back the opposition, it could further destabilize the country and require a more robust military presence inside the country. A classified CIA intelligence analysis reflected that view as well, according to a person familiar with the document. For Mr. Trump, the focus in Venezuela is oil, not promoting democracy. And even though Ms. Machado has gone out of her way to please Mr. Trump, in reality, her relationship with the White House had been fraying for months. Senior U.S. officials had grown frustrated with her assessments of Mr. Maduro's strength, feeling that she provided inaccurate reports that he was weak and on the verge of collapse. They also grew skeptical of her ability to seize power in Venezuela. Representatives for Ms. Machado did not respond to requests for comment. In fact, she had been a source of friction inside the Trump administration since soon after the president returned to office last January. Shortly before a visit to the capital, Caracas, in January, Richard Grenell, Mr. Trump's envoy, met with Ms. Machado's representatives in the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in Washington. Mr. Grenell asked them to arrange an in-person meeting with Ms. Machado in Caracas and for a list of political prisoners they wanted liberated. But the in-person meeting never happened. Ms. Machado, despite promises from the American delegation that she would be protected, refused to meet with Mr. Grenell. Instead, a phone call was arranged during his visit, according to multiple people briefed on the call. The phone call was cordial, but over time the relationship deteriorated, according to people briefed on the interactions. Ms. Machado and her team ignored the request for a list of political prisoners out of apparent desire to avoid accusations of favoritism or of intimating that her movement is taking part in the negotiations. Mr. Grenell repeatedly pressed Ms. Machado to outline her plan for putting her surrogate candidate, Edmundo Gonzalez, into office after she was barred from running. He grew frustrated when she expressed no concrete ideas of how to put the democratically elected government into power, according to people briefed on the conversations. For her part, Ms. Machado was also upset that Mr. Grenell, unlike Mr. Rubio, did not forcefully denounce Mr. Maduro as illegitimate. Mr. Grenell told colleagues that such a statement, while true, would undercut his diplomatic outreach. Mr. Grenell declined to comment. For now, Mr. Trump and Mr. Rubio have said they are focused on working with the interim president of Venezuela, Delcy Rodriguez, a vice president under Mr. Maduro. We are dealing with the immediate reality, Mr. Rubio said on Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press. The immediate reality is that, unfortunately and sadly, but unfortunately, the vast majority of the opposition is no longer present inside of Venezuela. We have short-term things that have to be addressed right away. Freddy Guevara, a former Venezuelan congressman living in exile in New York and a member of Ms. Machado's coalition, said that he did not know why the White House had chosen to move forward with Ms. Rodriguez. But his best guess was that it was the easiest path for now. I think the Americans are not betting on a revolution, but on reforms, he said. He and his fellow opposition members are now focused on pushing first for the release of political prisoners in Venezuela, and then for the ability to return to Venezuela and compete in open elections. We're going to keep organizing people and doing our thing inside Venezuela, Mr. Guevara said. But the one who's holding the gun now is the American government. And we hope that these guys learn that the Americans are not playing and that now there's a credible threat if they don't comply. Mr. Trump's embrace of Ms. Rodriguez is also forcing some Republicans, who have been staunch supporters of Ms. Machado, into difficult positions. Miami's three Republican members of Congress faced repeated questions in a news conference on Saturday night about why Mr. Trump had dismissed Ms. Machado. One of the lawmakers, Representative Mario Diaz-Balart, took offense at any suggestion that he or his colleagues no longer backed Ms. Machado. They reiterated their strong support for her, but did not venture any explanations for Mr. Trump's words. I'm convinced that when there are elections, whether there are new elections or there's a decision to take the old elections, the last elections, that the next democratically elected president of Venezuela is going to be Maria Corina Machado, Mr. Diaz-Balart said. Ms. Machado, a scion of the conservative magnate, had built strong connections in the Republican Party over the decades spent in Venezuelan politics, but she appeared little prepared for the transformation of the party into a transactional, ideologically agnostic political machine under Trump. Categorical rejection of any talks or contact with Mr. Maduro's government has been a bedrock of Ms. Machado's political strategy, a strategy that has earned her the respect and support of a majority of Venezuelan people, but it has crippled her ability to build a broader coalition capable of enabling her bid for power. Ms. Machado's unequivocal support of sanctions has destroyed her relations with Venezuela's business elite, which had built a modus vivendi with Mr. Maduro to continue working in the country after a quarter century of his government's rule. Ms. Machado's economic advisors have argued that every dollar going into Venezuela was a dollar for Mr. Maduro, a radical stance that had alienated many members of Venezuela's civil society working to improve living conditions in the country. Her message had increasingly begun to mirror the views of the diaspora and deviated from the realities of people who remained in Venezuela. As Mr. Trump tightened his economic sanctions over Venezuela in recent months, Ms. Machado remained largely silent, reducing her statements to the praise of Mr. Trump and publicizing the suffering of the hundreds of Venezuelan political prisoners. She has not issued a comment on the cancellation of most flights into Venezuela, the deportation of tens of thousands of Venezuelan migrants from the United States, the skyrocketing inflation in the country, or the collapse of oil revenues, which finance the import of basic goods into the country. Instead, members of Ms. Machado's team and allies in exile took to social media to attack and discredit public figures whose work deviated from their views. These actions cost Ms. Machado the support of members of the Democratic Party and many business people, American and Venezuelan, who had interests in Venezuela and influence in Mr. Trump's orbit. Orlando J. Perez, a professor of political science at the University of North Texas at Dallas, said Mr. Trump's comment on Saturday about Ms. Machado shocked him. The statement that she is not respected inside, I think, is not true on the face of it, he said. She clearly is the most popular opposition leader. She clearly has the legitimacy that the Nobel Peace Prize gives her. But Mr. Perez said Mr. Trump's comment reflected the infeasibility of Ms. Machado's taking power without a significant American military presence. They don't have the levers of power, he said, as Ms. Machado and Mr. Gonzalez. They don't have the institutions, and without us over assistance, they're not going to get back into power in Venezuela. Mr. Trump's comments were also widely noticed among Venezuelans in South Florida, who tend to feel deep affection for Ms. Machado. We were a little surprised by what he said about Maria Corina, said Nelson Jimenez, 55, who left Venezuela in 2020. Mr. Jimenez said Mr. Trump might be ill-informed about how much support Ms. Machado has in Venezuela. I think he's wrong, he said. Bela Fleck withdraws from Kennedy Center concerts. Performing there has become charged and political, the 18-time Grammy winner said. The celebrated banjo player Bela Fleck announced on Tuesday that he had withdrawn from three concerts at the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, becoming the latest artist to forego playing at the venue amid changes from the Trump administration. Mr. Fleck, an 18-time Grammy Award winner, was scheduled to play with the National Symphony Orchestra in February. Several musicians have cut ties with the Kennedy Center since its board voted last month to add President Trump's name to the institution. It has become less and less a musically and artistically based situation and more of a highly politicized and divisive one, Mr. Fleck said in a statement to the New York Times. This pushes against the deepest motivations of why I want to be a musician. In a social media post announcing his withdrawal, Mr. Fleck said that performing at the Kennedy Center had become charged and political at an institution where the focus should be on the music. When asked for comment, the Kennedy Center pointed to a social media post by its president, Richard Grenell, who responded to Mr. Fleck's post by saying, "You just made it political and caved to the woke mob who wants you to perform for only lefties." An updated listing on the Kennedy Center's website said that Mr. Fleck, who was scheduled to play Rhapsody in Blue by George Gershwin, had pulled out of the concerts because of personal issues. Replacing him is the orchestra's principal clarinetist, Lynn Ma, who will perform Aaron Copland's clarinet concerto. In his statement, Mr. Fleck said he was in a no-win situation because performing at the Kennedy Center would disappoint left-leaning fans, while withdrawing would anger right-leaning fans. I also am cognizant that not performing punishes the symphony for something they have nothing to do with, which is why it has taken me a while to decide what to do here, he said. Gene Davidson, the executive director of the National Symphony Orchestra, said in a statement that the organization was sorry Mr. Fleck would not be part of the program. Our audience will miss him, and we hope to welcome him back in the future. Mr. Fleck, who also has one Latin Grammy, could add to his trophy case next month the album Beat Trio with the harpist Edmar Castañeda and the drummer Antonio Sanchez, received a Grammy nomination for Best Contemporary Instrumental Album. The performers who have withdrawn from events at the Kennedy Center over the past few weeks include Stephen Schwartz, the composer of the musicals Wicked and Godspell, Chuck Redd, a jazz musician who had long hosted a free Christmas Eve concert, and the jazz septet The Cookers, who canceled two New Year's Eve concerts. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the January 7th issue of the New York Times, Venezuela Live Updates. U.S. forces seize two tankers. Rubio lays out plans for Venezuela. The U.S. Secretary of State unveiled a three-part plan for Venezuela's near future that gives Washington control over interim authorities as the U.S. forces boarded a Russian flag tanker and a second ship. Hours after the U.S. military seized two oil tankers on Wednesday, including a Russian-flagged tanker that had been invading American forces for weeks, the American Secretary of State laid out a plan for Venezuela's near future that included the United States imposing its will over interim authorities. The seizure of the tankers escalated a confrontation with Moscow after the ouster of its ally, President Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela. The U.S. military issued a statement saying that forces had seized the Russian-flagged vessel in the North Atlantic between Scotland and Iceland for violating U.S. sanctions. The ship, which was not carrying oil, had previously tried to sail to Venezuela to pick up crude and had been eluding U.S. forces for more than 2 weeks. Venezuela's state-run oil company confirmed for the first time that it is negotiating the sale of crude oil to the United States. This process is being developed under frameworks similar to those currently in effect with international companies such as Chevron, and is based on a strictly commercial transaction, the company Petróleos de Venezuela said in a statement published on social media. Venezuela's most important research center, the Venezuelan Institute of Scientific Research, said on Wednesday that its facilities were severely damaged by two U.S. missiles during the raid on Saturday. In a social media post, it said its mathematics department in Miranda State housed servers and essential equipment for our computer networks that were completely devastated, and its physics, chemistry, ecology, and nuclear technology departments were also damaged. This is an unprecedented act of imperial aggression, the Post said. There is no justification to attack a sanctuary of science, Alberto Quintero, the Institute's director, released a video identifying metal fragments as remains of one missile, an AGM-154C1, a sophisticated, precision-guided glide bomb. Oil firms say Venezuela owes them billions, complicating Trump's plan. Companies like ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips say that Venezuela owes them billions of dollars for confiscating their assets 2 decades ago. Western oil companies have been fighting to recoup tens of millions of dollars that they say Venezuela owes them, debts that could greatly complicate efforts by President Trump to compel U.S. businesses to produce more oil in the country. ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips top the list of oil companies with big financial claims against Venezuela, whose president, Nicolas Maduro, was captured by U.S. forces over the weekend in Caracas. American and European oil companies once had significant operations in Venezuela, ranked as having the world's largest proven oil reserves. But most Western energy businesses abandoned the country after disputes with its leftist government. And since then, corruption, mismanagement, and neglect have greatly eroded oil production. The foreign oil companies have been fighting for 2 decades to be compensated for being forced out of the country under Mr. Maduro's predecessor, Hugo Chavez. oil executives and experts have said that until those debts are resolved, these companies will be very reluctant to invest more in the country, something Mr. Trump has made one of his key aims for reviving Venezuela's economy. In the mid-2000s, the Chavez government demanded that oil companies accept a smaller stake in Venezuelan projects without compensation. Most foreign companies left the country rather than accept the new terms. ConocoPhillips' claims against Venezuela add up to $12 billion, while ExxonMobil, the largest U.S. oil company, has said the country owes it an estimated $20 billion. Chevron is the only U.S. oil company that stayed in Venezuela. That gambit has put it in a potential position to reap a significant reward as the Trump administration presses the country to accept greater U.S. investment. ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, and other companies have spent years trying to make Venezuela pay through international arbitration aid cases in U.S. courts. It's a stigmatizing action against a country, Sean Hyatt, director of the SAGE Business of Energy Initiative at the Marshall School of Business at the University of Southern California. It's basically telling everybody that they're never going back in the country. European energy companies, including Italy's Eni, France's Total Energies, and Spain's Repsol, have invested billions of dollars in Venezuela through their operations were much smaller than those of ExxonMobil and Phillips, said Mr. Hyatt, who has long tracked the oil industry in Venezuela. While oil companies have categorized those debts as unlikely to be repaid, they are highly unlikely to give up on their claims. ConocoPhillips may end up recouping some of its losses as part of a U.S. bankruptcy court's auction of Citgo, an American subsidiary of Venezuela's state-owned oil company Petróleos de Venezuela. ConocoPhillips declined to comment beyond what it has said in regulatory filings. ExxonMobil has said in regulatory filings that it collected awards of $908 million related to its investment in the Cerro Negro project in eastern Venezuela, and $260 million in compensation related to the La Ceiba project on a port in the nation's central region. But another $1.4 million arbitration award was annulled in the International Center for Settlement of Investment Disputes. Exxon filed a new claim to restore the award, but that and the large majority of Exxon's claims have gone unpaid. ExxonMobil did not respond to requests for comment. Venezuela has contested many foreign oil company claims and said it owes much less or nothing at all. U.S. and European oil companies have been speaking with the Trump administration about their next step in Venezuela, but new investments pose significant challenges because of the political instability created by Mr. Maduro's capture. Mr. Trump said on Saturday the U.S. oil companies would spend billions of dollars, fix the badly broken infrastructure, and start making money for the country. An Energy Department spokesman said that Chris Wright, the Energy Secretary, remains in close contact with U.S. oil companies and plans to meet with several of them at a conference on Wednesday. But investors remain wary. ExxonMobil's stock price fell more than 3% on Tuesday. ConocoPhillips fell more than 1%. And Chevron's share price dropped more than 4% after significant gains on Monday, even before the Trump administration seized Mr. Maduro The cost of restoring Venezuela's oil production would have been substantial. The Inter-American Development Bank, the primary source development financing in South America and the Caribbean, estimated in 2020 that it would cost $10 billion a year over a decade to restore Venezuela's oil production. The Center for Energy Studies at the Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy estimated that Venezuela's production peaked in 1998 at 3.4 million barrels of oil a day and dropped to 1.3 million barrels a day by 2018. In 2020 report, the center noted that the failure to attract more investment into its oil industry has been one of the key drivers of the economic catastrophe facing the country. Kennedy's Health Department flips food pyramid to emphasize red meat and dairy. Dietary guidelines. The Trump administration released new dietary guidelines on Wednesday that flip the food pyramid on its head, putting steak, cheese, and whole milk near the top. The new guidelines codify some of Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s frequent talking points, like recommending that people cook with butter and beef tallow, despite the fact that scientific evidence does not support doing so. But on other points, the guidelines do not stray far from mainstream nutrition advice. The new guidelines urge Americans to prioritize protein and avoid the sugary processed foods that Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has said are poisonous to health. My message is clear: eat real food. Mr. Kennedy said at a briefing rolling out the guidelines, where he positioned them as the key to preventing chronic disease and improving Americans' health. After years of being advised to avoid eating too much red meat and foods high in fats, Americans are now being told to embrace them. The document, which is far shorter than previous versions, codifies some of Mr. Kennedy's frequent talking points. On other points, the guidelines do not stray far from mainstream nutrition advice. They encourage Americans to eat plenty of fruits and vegetables and stop short of explicitly saying that people should eat more saturated fats, though Mr. Kennedy had pledged to end the war on them. And they make no direct mention of seed oils, a frequent target for Mr. Kennedy, who has repeatedly claimed, without evidence, they harm health. The guidelines have been endorsed by the American Medical Association, a group that just days ago sharply condemned Mr. Kennedy's upheaval of the childhood vaccine schedule. At the briefing, Mr. Kennedy also thanked the American Academy of Pediatrics for partnering with the administration, an organization that is suing Mr. Kennedy over his changes to vaccine policy. The American Heart Association issued a lukewarm statement of support for the new guidelines, voicing concern that they could lead people to consume too much saturated fat and sodium. While the guidelines say that people can season their meats and vegetables with salt, they also recommended avoiding salty processed foods and do not change the limits on sodium. As the Health and Agriculture Department's official guidance on what to eat and drink for good health, the guidelines shape the foods served in schools, hospitals, prisons, military bases, and through federal assistance programs. They are updated every 5 years and rarely change in substance. But Mr. Kennedy was dismissive of the recommendations of an expert committee tapped to oversee the guidelines during the Biden administration, instead turning to a new set of hand-picked experts who worked in secret over the last few months. Mr. Kennedy had criticized previous guidelines as having been influenced by food industry. But 5 of the 10 current scientific experts disclosed recent financial relationships with beef, dairy, or pork industries, or food, infant formula, supplement, or pharmaceutical companies. The guidelines focus on priorities for Mr. Kennedy and his Make America Healthy Again movement, emphasizing protein, which most Americans already get enough of. They advise adults to consume 1.2 to 1.6 grams per kilogram of body weight per day, 50 to 100% more than what federal health officials have previously recommended for people's basic needs. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. There isn't solid evidence that everyone needs to consume this much protein, but many experts already recommend similar amounts for people who are trying to lose weight or are strength training to build muscle. The new guidelines say that people can get protein from animal sources like red meat, poultry, seafood, eggs and dairy, and plant sources like legumes, nuts, and seeds and soy. While research suggests that getting more of your protein from plant rather than animal sources can reduce risks of cardiovascular disease and earlier death, the new guidelines don't steer people toward plant proteins. They also take a hard line on added sugars, telling people to avoid sugar-sweetened beverages and to limit other sources of the sugars. They also recommend that children do not start eating added sugars until they are 10, much later than previous guidelines, which recommended avoiding added sugars until age 2. The new guidelines recommend significantly cutting back on highly processed, refined carbohydrates, which they define as white bread, flour tortillas, and crackers. Mr. Kennedy has long condemned ultra-processed foods, typically defined as those with ingredients not commonly used in home kitchens, which has been linked to a range of health conditions including obesity, type 2 diabetes, and heart disease. While the new guidelines did not directly use the term ultra-processed foods, they do recommend avoiding a more vague category of highly processed items like chips, cookies, and candy that have added sugars or sodium, and those that contain certain additives including artificial flavors, preservatives, petroleum-based dyes, and low-calorie sweeteners. For months, Mr. Kennedy and Dr. Marty Makary, the Food and Drug Administration Commissioner, had said that the new guidelines would end the so-called war on saturated fats, prompting consumer health groups and nutrition experts to worry that the new guidelines would recommend that people consume more saturated fats. That move would put people's health at risk, experts said, since saturated fats have been shown to raise cholesterol levels and the risk of cardiovascular disease. The administration kept the saturated fat recommendation unchanged, suggesting that no more than 10% of daily calories should come from the fats. But the guidelines also include the contradictory advice to prioritize foods that are high in saturated fats, such as red meat, full-fat dairy products, and butter and beef tallow. Consuming 1 8-ounce ribeye steak, for example, would put many people over their daily saturated limit. On alcohol, the guidelines are vague, recommending that people consume less, but offering no concrete guidance on what that means. Previous guidelines have recommended that men have no more than 2 drinks per day, and women no more than 1. Buy Greenland, take it, why? An old pact already gives Trump a free hand. Analysts say the Cold War agreement allows the president to increase the American military presence almost at will. President Trump has ridiculed Denmark's dog sled teams in Greenland. He has cited mysterious Chinese and Russian ships prowling off the coast. He seems increasingly fixated on the idea that the United States should take over this gigantic ice-bound island, with one official saying the president wants to buy it, and another suggesting that the United States could simply take it. Just a few days ago, Mr. Trump said, "We need Greenland from the standpoint of national security." But the question is, does the United States even need to buy Greenland, or do something more drastic to accomplish all of Mr. Trump's goals? Under a little-known Cold War agreement, the United States already enjoys sweeping military access in Greenland. Right now, the United States has one base in a very remote corner of the island, but the agreement allows it to construct, install, maintain, and operate military bases across Greenland, house personnel, and control landings, takeoffs, anchorages, moorings, movements, and operation of ships, aircraft, and waterborne craft. It was signed in 1951 by the United States and Denmark, which colonized Greenland more than 300 years ago and still controls some of its affairs. The U.S. has such a free hand in Greenland that it can pretty much do what it wants, said Mikael Rung Olsen, a researcher at the Danish Institute for International Studies in Copenhagen. "I have a very hard time seeing that the U.S. couldn't get pretty much everything it wanted," he said, adding, "if it just asked nicely." But buying Greenland, something that Secretary of State Marco Rubio told lawmakers on Tuesday was Mr. Trump's latest plan, is a different question. Greenland does not want to be bought by anyone, especially not the United States, and Denmark does not have the authority to sell it, Dr. Olsen said. "It is impossible," he said. In the past, Denmark would have been the decider. In 1946, it refused the Truman administration's offer of $100 million in gold. Today, things are different. Greenlanders now have the right to hold a referendum on independence, and Danish officials have said it's up to the island's 57,000 inhabitants to decide their future. A poll last year found 85% of residents opposed the idea of an American takeover. Greenland's Prime Minister Jens Frederik Nielsen has repeatedly scoffed at the idea of being bought, saying this past week, "Our country is not for sale." The relatively short, straightforward defense agreement between the United States and Denmark was updated in 2004 to include Greenland's semi-autonomous government, giving it a say in how American military operations might affect the local population. The roots of the agreement go back to a partnership forged during World War II. At that time, Denmark was occupied by the Nazis. Its ambassador in Washington, cut off from Copenhagen, took it upon himself to strike a defense agreement for Greenland with the United States. The island is part of North America, along the Arctic Ocean, and close to Canada's coast. The fear was that Nazis could use Greenland as a stepping stone to America. The Germans had already established small meteorological bases on the island's east coast and relayed information for battles in Europe. American troops eventually ousted them and established more than a dozen bases there with thousands of troops, landing strips, and other military facilities. After World War II, the United States continued to run some bases and a string of early warning radar sites. As the Cold War wound down, the United States closed all of them except one. It's now called the Pacific Space Base and helps track missiles crossing the North Pole. The Danes have a light presence too, a few hundred troops, including special forces that use dog sleds to conduct long-range patrols. In recent months, the Danish government has vowed to upgrade its bases and increase surveillance. After American special forces captured Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela, from a safe house last week, Mr. Trump seemed emboldened. Stephen Miller, a top aide, then claimed that Greenland should belong to the United States and that nobody's going to fight the United States over it. Danish and Greenlandic anxiety skyrocketed. On Tuesday night, Danish and Greenlandic leaders asked to meet with Mr. Rubio, according to Greenland's foreign minister. It's not clear if or when that might happen. Tensions between Mr. Trump and Denmark's Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen have been steadily rising as Mr. Trump pushes to get Greenland, as he puts it, while Ms. Frederiksen refuses to kowtow to him. Just a few days ago, Ms. Frederiksen cited the 1951 agreement, saying, "We already have a defense agreement between the Kingdom and the United States today, which gives the United States wide access to Greenland." She urged the United States to stop the threats and said an American attack on Greenland would mean the end of the international world order. European leaders issued their own statement on Tuesday, also citing the 1951 agreement and saying Greenland belongs to its people. Analysts said that if the United States tried to use the Defense Pact as a fig leaf to send in a lot of troops and try to occupy Greenland, that wouldn't be legal either. According to this 2004 amendment, the United States is supposed to consult with Denmark and Greenland before it makes any significant changes in military operations on the island. The 2004 amendment, which was signed by General Colin Powell, who was then the Secretary of State, explicitly recognizes Greenland as an equal part of the Kingdom of Denmark. Listening to a reading of articles and features from the January 5th and January 7th issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Elizabeth Ortel. Thank you for listening.